Good afternoon, everybody. For those that I don't know, my name is Nina Larkin and I'm a director at PwC in the actuarial and risk consulting business. So I guess in addition to helping the banking industry around the measurement of credit risk in their book, I'm also currently in the market for buying my first family home. So this topic of conversation is really dear to me at this point in time. And I'm really looking forward to hearing what these two gentlemen have to say to us today. I think Wayne summarised it really well in one of his recent speeches where he said, it is not unusual nowadays wherever you are over a meal, whether it be at a dinner table or at a backyard barbecue, for the conversation to turn to the housing market and mortgages. So this is probably something that is dear to all of us. So I guess during this plenary session, we'll have our two speakers, James and Sean, and they're going to talk to us about their views on the current mortgage market. After hearing Wayne and Guy speak today, we know that the mortgage market is the crown jewels of all the asset classes, with its historically high return on equity and strong fat margins, its resilience during the GFC. We didn't have the same crisis as they have had overseas. Did some work in Ireland, and we are nothing like Ireland when it comes to the mortgage space and the property market. We've had the historical low losses, as some of the graphs that were shown up before. So it's really seen as a really safe asset class. However, times are changing, and there's a high scrutiny and pressure in this particular part of the industry with high capital. We've heard about the 25% correlation. That could just be the beginning. It was an interim measure. Is there more to come? There's higher customer demands. We heard from earlier in terms of better service, better speed. You know, people want more from their bank when it comes to the products that are being offered. And lastly, the greater risk of disruption with new entrants, with innovation, and how that plays out in the mortgage industry. So with that kind of as an overview in terms of what we're hoping to talk about in this plenary session, I would like to introduce our first speaker, James. So James Hickey is a partner in Deloitte and has worked with Deloitte for over 20 years across Australia, New Zealand, South Africa and the United Kingdom. He is a fellow, one of us, and is based down here in Sydney. James leads the actuarial advice services in the banking sector. This ranges from strategy and operating model reviews to deep technical analysis on lending portfolios. His clients include major banks, regional banks, credit unions, non-banks, and mortgage broker distribution groups. James is also the lead author of Deloitte's annual Australian Mortgage Report, which has been running for 10 consecutive years. This covers trends and challenges in the residential mortgage market for consumers, banks, and brokers. So without further ado, James.
Thank you. Let's get my slides up. I've got my watch here because I'm terrible at keeping the time. So Nina says she'll wind me up when it comes to the 20 minutes. I'm going to share with you today some of the findings from our Deloitte Mortgage Report. They have been a bit refreshed, but as Nina said in the intro, we do an annual research piece in the Australian mortgage market. It's very much in conjunction with lenders and broker groups, so we get the pulse of what's happening across the mortgage sector, and I'll share with you some of those findings today. Often the hardest thing when you do a research report, as I'm sure you're all aware, is what's the title of the report. So this year we went with the title, Let the Good Times Roll. And it's a bit of an exclamation mark and a question mark, because is it really the best time? You can talk to many first home buyers and they would probably not agree with that. You can talk to many sellers in the last 12 months and they may well agree with that. So it really is a real conundrum at the moment in the Australian mortgage market. Look, there's been a lot of records set recently, in particular in 2014, but also stretching well into 2015. A lot of very good records, and we've sort of said here some not-so-good records in the Australian mortgage market. In terms of many of the good records that we've seen, total outstanding mortgage lending is now $1.5 trillion. For those of you in the superannuation field, you all say, well, where's the other $500 billion there? Because it's up to $2 trillion now, but anyway. The mortgage market is a substantial and the largest credit market in the banking sector. National Housing Finance Commitments, which is the industry proxy for settlements or new flow of lending, it peaked at only $35 billion in June. June 2015. Now we'll see a chart in a moment which goes to show that's over 20% growth on where it was tracking, you know, 12, 18 months prior, and that's just the buoyancy we're seeing across settlement flows in this market. Look, interest rates are at record lows. We've got there 4.45% as DVR. I mean, whilst lenders quote standard variable rate, which is SVR, you never pretty much pay a standard variable rate. You're always getting a discounted variable rate. Generally, at the moment, if you can't get 100 basis points off on standard variable rate, then you're not trying hard enough. I'm just in the process of taking another property at the moment, and my broker got me 139 basis points off. So, Sean, if that's it's not with your group, but although I am a very good risk, I must add. But so it's really a very deep market for discounts at the moment, and I'm sure Sean will cover some of it. But it's a real challenge if you're a lender, because how can you keep on giving heavily discounted rates for new borrowers? What do you do with the back book? How do you treat your existing customers to stop them from refinancing? So it's a really competitive market at the moment for rates, which is great for consumers. Defaults and losses are at record lows, and they have been for quite a while now, although we are starting to see some uptick in levels of arrears and delinquency. But I won't spend much on it today, because I'm sure Sean will cover a lot of that detail in portfolios in a moment. Margins are very good, especially if you're a major bank. You're generally able to sustain a margin of, you know, well north of 200 basis points on your residential mortgage book. There can be a little bit of noise given the transfer pricing across different parts of the portfolio. But if you look at the regional or second tier lenders, they're probably around the 150 to 170 basis points. So there's a clear differential in terms of the NIM, which the majors can extract versus what the regionals can extract. Now, part of that's cost of funding differentials, but part of it's also just the willingness to have to compete that the regionals have to try to grow their business. We're seeing a lot of technology advancements. E-settlements, hopefully they're not too far away. But again, having been through the process recently of going through a settlement, I know they're still not here, because it's a very cumbersome paper-based process from end to end, and there's a real opportunity in the marketplace to make that more technologically enabled. And competition, we've said here, is a good thing. Certainly we saw in the back half of 2014 and 2015 that the reliance upon the majors had reduced to be less than 70% of all new lending, which, you know, you may think the majors may not like that, but in fact they probably do, because it spreads the burden of funding out, and it means that the non-bank lenders, the second-tier lenders, are also taking a fair load of new lending over the marketplace, and that's giving competition back to consumers. So there's some of the good records for the year. The not so good ones, I'm sure if you're a first home buyer out there, it is tough. First home buyer proportions, the metric varies, but generally speaking, it's around half of what it was in the peak of 2010-2011 time, and probably around mid-teens at the moment in terms of all new lending. It is very difficult for first-time buyers, especially in Sydney and Melbourne, if that's where your career and where your work is, to try to find out how are you going to raise the money for a deposit if you want to avoid LMI. If you're saving, what sort of asset class you put those savings in to keep pace with property price growth? If property prices are growing 15 to 20% a year, try to find another asset class where your deposit's going to grow that quickly. So it's a real challenge for many first-time buyers out there. We said investor lending was north of 40% of all new settlements. Obviously, with APRA's I suppose speed bumps for some of the lenders out there, that is slowing because there was concern about the investor segment growing too quickly. But there was also concerns, is that crowding out some first home buyers? Is that the right dynamic that lenders, and to be honest, the government, is that the balance that they want in the mortgage sector? Property and salary growth, again, this is you've got to look at this through the cycle, but it's very tough to see that property prices can keep growing at 15 to 20% per annum if salaries aren't matching that. You know, that gap can only widen for so long before you really get to a position of concern, especially for lenders with their portfolios. And so there's a lot of close scrutiny done around that. You know, is the property and wage growth there to support the is the wage growth there to support the property price growth? And look, two other comments. You know, I spend a lot of time here in the country, and I can tell you, you go to Brisbane at the moment, and there's a lot of stock for sale. It's not going gangbusters. It's struggling to move. You go to WA, and with the resource and mining boom reduction we've seen recently, it's a tougher market. You go to regional Australia, it's really quite slow. The economy's not going great in those regional areas. So I think we can be cocooned living primarily in Sydney and Melbourne, that we think the rest of the Australian property market's just what we're experiencing here. Well, it's not. It is quite unique to Sydney and Melbourne. So the challenge is, if the regulator and the politicians and the central bank try to do macro-prudential levers, to cool off the Sydney and Melbourne market, that can have unfair consequences on the rest of the market. So it is a tough one out there at the moment. All right, just to show you a few charts. So this chart I've aptly called up and to the right. Now, normally when you do a chart, you like that. You think, oh, that's good, up and to the right, must mean a positive story. Well, it is in terms of settlement growth, which is that black line that you can see on the chart measured against the right-hand axis. That black line is the level of monthly settlements across the country. So you can see pretty much in 2010, it's had a very rapid increase, and in particular since December 2012. And we'll see later that was about a 20% per annum growth year on year for the last 2 to 3 years in terms of volume of new lending. Now that includes refinancing of existing facilities within that, as borrowers have sought better deals. But that's a really strong growth of new flow that's happening. The blue columns is the back book measured on the left-hand axis, the $1.5 trillion. So obviously, if you're a lender, in particular a major, yes, you can look at that growth. The flow is coming in at 20% plus per annum, but what's happening on your back book and how quick are the loans refinancing or exiting on your back book? So a lot of lenders are spending a lot of time around advanced analytics on what sort of customers are most receptive to a refinance activity and how can you get to them far sooner than them electing to do it themselves. So it's been a spectacularly solid growth story for settlements, at least in the market. So I've got a few captions here from some of the roundtable attendees to our mortgage report. You can see the quote from Macquarie Bank, and home ownership is it's an aspirational aim for nearly every Australian. It's been drummed into us through generations. I'm sure if you ask your parents what should I be aspiring to do, they'll say own your own home. So it's one of those things where in Australia in particular, the psyche is to own your own property. That's not the same around the world. Some countries are far more advanced and they have far more of a culture around leasing and renting and long-term leasing, which is not something we have here in Australia. So it is quite unique around this home ownership aspect that we cling to here. And part of me wonders whether we do need to start to change the expectation of people that home ownership is the only way to go. Can we not look at other forms of longer-term leasing or other forms of long-term housing which may suit people better going forward? And then when you look at ANZ quoted this, whilst the total outstanding mortgage lending market is $1.5 trillion, that's measured against a stock of $5.7 trillion. So you can do the math there about the average LVR. It is a relatively low average LVR. Having said that, generally about 80 to 85% of Australians over the age of 65 own their own home outright. And if there's about 20% of the population over age 65 and they've got their own home outright with no mortgage against it, then they own a chunk of that $5.7 trillion. Then the rest becomes largely the stock which has a mortgage over it. But it's still a very big market. And so while we look at mortgages, a big challenge for governments and other lenders at the moment is what to do with the other equity that people have in their housing stock, particularly in retirement, and how does that work with the retirement income policy. But that's a whole other topic. Oh, look, we asked our roundtable attendees, where's the activity at the moment in the market? And without a doubt, they all chose refinances and upgraders. They're going to be driving the market over the next 2 to 3 years. This comes to the view, and you see on the right-hand side, that first-time buyers are only a small segment of their second most popular response. The reason that refinances and upgraders were, everyone voted that they would be the most dominant form of activity, is that these are people who currently own a home. And I think if you're in Sydney or Melbourne and you currently have property, then it's not too hard to upgrade that property because you've got the equity growth. You've held onto the property for a number of years, you've serviced the mortgage, you get the 20% growth in equity, you can then refinance or upgrade. Very hard for first home buyers who haven't had that equity to actually keep pace with the property market in Australia. We're seeing investors there, and we particularly split out local investors versus self-managed super funds, or non-SMSF versus SMSF, and then we also have foreign or overseas investors, just to try to distinguish those categories. So there was still a feeling that primarily it's the non-self-managed super fund investor that's going to be driving a lot of activity as well. Quite simply because they're used to the process. Generally, they're more comfortable taking the gearing strategy around doing that. We asked the group, well, there are all the great things about the market, the 20% per annum growth, record low rates, losses are low. What's there to be worried about if you're a lender? And I'm sure Sean will go into a lot more details about this. There are concerns out there, no doubt. And we asked the group to just comment on what they saw as the top two areas of concern. Now, this was a survey we did back at the end of 2014, December 2014, so you can see that response B was macroprudential limits on lending being introduced. I mean, at the time, we'd seen the RBNZ introduce similar ones in New Zealand to curb the Auckland property price growth. Obviously, now we have seen some direct instruction from the regulator around investor lending in Australia, so that has come through, and that was expected back in December. But the other response is a bit of a nebulous one, a downturn in economic growth. But it is a concern because if we said it before, if you're in Sydney and Melbourne, the markets seem rosy. If you're outside of those capital cities, there are many industries who may be linked to the energy and resources and mining sector that are really struggling at the moment as that part of the sector slows down. The regional areas don't have the growth impetus that we're seeing in the capital cities. But overall, if there's an economic slowdown and unemployment starts to go up, then that is a concern for lenders because they look at the credit risk on their back book. How much confidence do we have in property growth going forward and salaries as well. There was another response there, the response A was inappropriate lending issues, which is always one to keep an eye on. As actuaries we've seen in the financial planning sector, mortgage brokers now control over 50% of all new mortgage lending. It's really important that the integrity and the quality of the advice that they give to borrowers is consistent with the expectations that are placed upon them from regulation, but also the lenders placed upon those mortgage brokers. So we've seen commentary about the potential for greater risk through brokers, but that's probably through any third-party proprietary channel, but you do need to keep a close eye on the quality of those groups. So there's an awareness of that, even amongst the broker groups. They're keeping a very close eye on the quality of the submissions of their brokers out there. That is very hard to read. It wasn't that way when I looked at it on my screen, so if you can just put your sunglasses on or something. But it does say one thing is clear, digital and data will be the main data for mortgages over the next 3 years. So we've probably heard earlier about the data and digital revolution, but it's really going to significantly change the way in which the traditional mortgage is provided to consumer, and also the way in which the consumer, I'm just going to get off that slide actually three times. And also the way in which consumers will expect the lender and the broker will interact with them. Again, I've been through a few occurrences lately where I've had a mortgage broker. I've used their service. It's been fantastic. They're very much a face-to-face or voice-to-voice service, which is fantastic because sometimes people just want that human element, that human interaction. You can probably do a lot of your own research online. You can go and see what rates might be best for you from different lenders, but you do want the second set of eyes looking at the decision you're making, because it is a big financial commitment you're getting into, and many people value the broker's input in that. But the broker's got to be seen as a digitally aware person as well. So my broker came to my house after hours, that's nothing new, a lot of them do that. But they came with an iPad, it was real-time enabled, it was all the swipe sort of stuff you'd expect. It was just all automatic, and it was digital. And that was a really good example of where brokers were integrating digital into their face-to-face service. It does start to fall over when you get to the lenders, and no disrespect to the lenders in the room, but you know, often we found it's the legal departments of the lenders which really have struggled with the electronic age, where they actually want an ink pen to sign a piece of paper, and that piece of paper can't be scanned, it needs to be returned in hand to the branch, and it needs to be printed one per page, a 50-page document. So there's a lot of challenging aspects around the digitising of the end-to-end process that lenders are facing, but consumers are expecting that there's going to be improvement there, and the lenders really have to meet their expectation. We just asked how more informed consumers now than they were 3 years ago. No surprise, you know, somewhat or substantially better informed. Yep. We had a fintech group come into us a few weeks ago in the office, and they do foreign exchange, a little bit off this topic, but they said they don't even offer a service now through their website. They said that's too old school, having an internet website that's all going to be tablet-enabled. That's the only way they'll accept dealing with the customer. So you think, how would a bank deal with that if I were doing a mortgage? No, it can only be through a tablet. But if that's what consumers are expecting, that it's all that real-time, in-your-hand, palm-enabled, that's a real technological challenge from what the current paper-based process is for a mortgage. We asked the group what features do borrowers want most in a mortgage when they're selecting a lender and a provider. Give two responses. No surprise there, the most common response was competitive rates. Now, it's interesting that it doesn't say cheapest rates. people expect that they will get a competitive rate from the lender they want to choose, but they will not always go with the lowest rate because they balance a number of other things up against it. So as long as you're a lender and you're seen as being competitive, you don't need to be the cheapest. And then the second most important aspect was technologically enabled. So being seen as innovative and accessible when the consumer wants to access their statements, their accounts. Now again, that can be more perception than reality. As long as you've got the perception of being technologically leading and you have all the apps and the expectations that the consumers have around how they engage with you, that's really important. Far more important than back office customer service and product features and flexibility. Just keeping on this thing about digital and where are the largest opportunity areas for digital around mortgages. Look, the group had a real scattergun of responses here, I think is the best way to put it. There's no single clear burning platform issue across digitising mortgages. It's across the board. Some of them that stood out were a straight-through mortgage. There's a lot of discussion about that. I'm not too sure, to be honest, that a straight-through, end-to-end, online or tablet-enabled mortgage from application through to settlement is really a feasible option or is really what a lot of people actually want. There may be some who want it now, but probably going forward it will be a growing group who expect that, or at least they expect to have that as the utopia of an option that they can have. I think the reality at the moment is more around the omni-channel experience. And by that I mean that consumers these days are unlikely to go through one channel for the entire process. They may go online and do a bit of research originally. They may then go to a comparison website and see what choices they've got. At each stage of entry data, they may call up a mortgage broker, and the mortgage broker may engage with them. They may then call the lender's call centre to ask a few questions. Through all those touch points, across all those different channels, they expect a consistency of service. And the thing that annoys consumers most is having to re-enter data and re-qualify themselves every single time across all those channels. And that's a real challenge for lenders at the moment. They're working out how to deliver an omni-channel experience from the consumer because that's really what they're expecting these days. The other one is to leverage customer data. So, you know, we're actuaries, we're great at doing that. We're very happy to take large volumes of data and get insights out of that. Our view was, and the lender's view was, consumers probably expect that we're looking at their data and that we can start to do good proactive offers around that should the consumer give us permission to do that. Because they think they expect that we know them as well as they know themselves. And as a lender, we've got all that data, and therefore we should be far more informed about it, rather than just sending out the typical old direct mail campaign to all your mortgage customers. You should be able to far more target that, engage with the consumers at the level they want to be engaged at, given the data that you've got about their behaviour. I must be close on time. 2 minutes, good. Okay. The greatest challenges to innovation. No surprise here. Technology constraints. Every lender has said that's the biggest hurdle that they face, and it's legacy systems. We're all actors. We've seen insurance company systems and lender systems. They can go back many decades. It's not easy to suddenly digitise and meet consumer expectations with a very antiquated system, both for back office and for front end processing. So it really is a challenge. There's been a lot of effort put around that, and I really think there's a role for actors to work with lenders around how they're actually spending time around that technology innovation, so they're actually addressing the right desires and aspirations of consumers. We then said, okay, well, how do you deal with that? Many lenders are using fintechs, startups, partnering with innovation groups out there to try to say, hey, it's very hard to innovate from inside an organisation often. It's very hard to look at your current IT platform and think, oh, okay, well, how can we innovate this? It's far better if you're working with someone who's an outside group who knows what consumers want and can tell you what they demand, and then you work from almost from the outside in and work out how your systems therefore need to be adapted or thrown out or adjusted to handle that. So many groups are doing selective partnering with startup groups. Again, the challenge that we have is a big culture of an organisation work with the nimble and agile culture, the perception of the nimbleness and agility of a startup without destroying the value that startup brings. All right, I thought this was an interesting quote from Jane Sheffield, who over various stages of CBA has been head of mortgages, head of mobile online channel, but he's a long-term client of ours. I thought it was a really interesting comment there that, you know, before you know it, CBA is going to think of itself more as a technology company that offers financial services than as a bank. that tries to get technology to serve banking needs of clients. Now, that's probably a far-out aspirational sort of view of where that group's going, but I think it's an interesting insight into the way in which big organisations need to think about themselves and how they engage with consumers. All right, very lastly, just in summary, I think we've been through some of these, that the growth dynamics are great at the moment in the market. Existing borrowers are probably going to be a source of a lot of the opportunities still going forward, but first-time buyers remains a structural challenge, I think, for the sector and for the government. Margins are good for majors. Non-majors are still, you know, they're going to struggle with competing on the front for customers and also paying more on the funding side and the cost of capital. But it's really around technology. You know, it's going to really drive a lot of the change and differentiation for a lot of groups going forward and how they engage with their customers, and digital is going to be at the forefront of that. That's it. So, thank you. I'll hand back to Nina to hand over to Sean.
Thank you, James. So, if I introduce our second speaker, Sean Carmody. Sean is the General Manager, Risk Analytics and Insights, with responsibility for stress testing, analytics data, and reporting across risk classes for the Westpac Group. Prior to his current role, Sean was the Head of Credit Risk and Westpac's Group Risk Function. He has also held positions as the Head of Fixed Interest at Barclays Global Investors Australia, Head of Credit Portfolio Management at Westpac, Director at Categorical Solutions, and Head of Quantitative Analysis at Deutsche Bank. Please join me in welcoming Sean.
Thanks, Nina, and thanks for the invitation. Now, some of you might recall back in February this year when our current CEO, Brian Harser, stepped into the role, that one of the things that the financial press seemed to be most interested in writing up was comments that he'd made about death to PowerPoint in the organisation. So with that inspiration, I'm going slide free today. Now, the good news there, that means no lime green, bright lime green slides. The bad news is that basically means you just get to look at me. So I understand if you feel the need to start looking at each other in the meantime as well. So that's quite okay. Anyway, thank you for the invitation to participate in the discussion today. As Nina observed, that housing is a barbecue-stopping conversation, and it's obviously also something that's a pretty important topic for all banks in Australia. For a bank like Westpac, mortgages represent about two-thirds of our assets on the balance sheet, so needless to say, something we spend a lot of time thinking about. But when I was reflecting on the title, The Best of Times, I was giving a bit of thought to what the illusion might be there in that topic, Best of Times. Now, put that in the context that if you scan a few opinions around the marketplace, read a few blogs, read a few articles, you'll get a pretty broad range of opinions. At one extreme, you'll get some that argue that the housing boom and the associated construction activity that we're seeing really taking off is really just what our economy needs right now. We've got the stimulus and mining activity slowing, and it's really picking that up, and it's perfect timing for the economy. But at the same time, you'll hear others holding the passionate conviction that we're in the Ponzi phase of the Minsky cycle and the bubble is about to burst. So with that breadth of opinion out there, I thought maybe the best of times might be an allusion to the opening line of Dickens' Tale of Two Cities, which is, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. It covers the full spectrum of views out there. But since I'm here to give a banking perspective, I thought maybe there was a better reference. Some of you who are old enough might recall the 1986 movie The Best of Times, starring Robin Williams as a banker. That's the link there. He played the character Jack Dundee, who was obsessed with the biggest mistake of his life, which was dropping a pass at a high school football game, and he spent the whole movie yearning to relive that event and have the opportunity to correct his mistake. But regardless of what that reference is, there's certainly interesting times for mortgage lending, and we're in an environment that's been changing very rapidly, particularly over the last 12 months. So to get the discussion going, we'll have plenty of time for questions and answers as well. I thought I'd take a bit of time to explore some of the key characteristics of the mortgage market and how, from a risk perspective, we think about mortgages at Westpac. And the way I'll structure the comments is I'll give a bit of broader historical context of Australian mortgages and how they've evolved over the last 20 years or so. Say a bit about what we're seeing in current conditions, but then I'll spend a fair bit of the time talking about stress testing and how we apply stress testing for thinking about mortgage risk for our own portfolio. And then I'll try and touch on that curly question of the future outlook and where we might head. So hopefully a look back in the past, the present, and the future might help answer us that best of times question. So, at Westpac, what do we mean when we talk about a mortgage? Basically, it's a loan secured by residential property. But we're a bit more specific than that, because there's actually a lot of lending that we do to small businesses that's also secured by residential property. But when we talk about mortgages, we're not talking about that sector of the market. Now, that's a whole interesting discussion in itself, and I know it's something that the Reserve Bank is interested in terms of the role that collateral plays in terms of transmission of monetary policy. But when we talk about the mortgage market, we're basically talking about lending for the purpose of buying a property, whether that's for owner occupation, for investment, or refinancing those loans. And that's also the same definition that APRA uses in its current macroprudential activity. And the market includes residents here in Australia, it includes non-residents, and also self-managed super fund is a small but growing component of that market. Now, the market has grown a lot over the last 20 years or so and evolved quite a bit. Now, any of those who are around long enough to recall mortgage lending back in before the early 90s would probably say that back then was the best of times for mortgages, because margins were pretty wide, because it was really only in around the early to mid-90s that we saw significant entrance from the non-bank lenders, the evolution and growth of securitisation markets that started to squeeze interest margins and started to bring some additional competition to the banking sector. And over that period, from that 90s period up all the way up until the onset of the financial crisis around 2008-2009, there was very significant growth in mortgage lending in the non-bank sector. And that spanned a pretty broad range, from very standard mortgages up to the higher risk, higher margin end of the market, so not quite subprime, but not exactly prime either. And over a similar period, mortgage broking also began to take a more important role in the market. And back as far as 2002, Aussie Home Loans, which at that time was the most significant non-bank player in the market, reinvented itself to become a broker rather than just an originator and lender. So all those developments brought really quite significant increases in competition to the market, but nevertheless, banks in Australia continued really to be the most significant players in the market. Now then, financial crisis hit around 2008, and that had a big impact, initially, on the mortgage market. So funding costs blew out, and securitisation markets virtually shut down, and essentially would have shut down if it wasn't for some support from the Australian Office of Financial Management. And that really severely constrained the non-bank lenders. Now, banks weren't immune to those sorts of challenges, but major banks in particular did benefit from flight to quality. They saw depositors coming more their way. The wholesale markets were certainly more expensive, but remained open to major banks, and government guarantees for a temporary period of time certainly didn't do any harm in that respect. And that really saw a shift back of market share and the banks, particularly the major banks, did in that immediate post-crisis period grow market share again. But since then, things obviously have normalised a fair bit, as was noted before. Australia, despite the global ructions, didn't really suffer nearly as badly, and things started to get back to normal, and non-bank lenders are active again, and the market's normalising, and growth has continued to be very rapid, and mortgage brokers are really playing, if anything, an even more significant part in the market. Now, as James had noted, around the most recent APRA statistics over July this year, we're looking at a mortgage market of about $1.5 trillion. And if you look at where we were, say, 10 years ago, we're about $500 billion. So that over a 10-year period, that's a compound annual growth rate of around 10%, and as James noted, in recent years, it's been even faster than that. Now, that's a very high rate of growth. And if you compare that to GDP growth, well above GDP growth. Now, of course, house prices have been going up over that period, but say over a similar 10-year period, we've probably seen annual compound growth across major capital cities of about 5% per annum. So that's a factor, but it doesn't explain the growth in mortgage debt. So it's been a pretty significant couple of decades, and it's a market that's really grown very much in size. The stock of mortgage debt is at very high levels and certainly looks high in a lot of international comparisons, and the majority of that is sitting in the banking sector, particularly with the major banks. So where does that leave us now, and where might we be heading? Now, if we take a bit of an economic perspective as to current conditions, there are certainly areas of heightened risk. Commodity prices have fallen significantly. There's not a lot of expectation that that's going to turn around anytime soon. Mining investment is slowed significantly. Business confidence has been dipping, although the recent events of Malcolm Turnbull's ascension looks at early signs to maybe give a bit of a fillip to business confidence. And there's certainly early evidence in our own mortgage portfolios and some of the statistics that mortgage insurers and the like provide that the mining slowdown is already translating into increases in delinquency rates in some of the affected areas such as Western Australia. So, and that's going to be consistent with the comments that James made about the level of activity in the housing market itself. So those two things tend to be linked. Now, providing a bit of offset in terms of the performance of the portfolios is that interest rates are obviously historic lows. And while the Westpac Economics current forecast is for rates to remain stable, more broadly out in the market, there's still indications that the market's factoring in another rate rise, a rate reduction. So while everyone's waiting and watching to see if the Fed is about to hike, we certainly here in Australia are not in a tightening cycle at this point. So that's a positive in terms of affordability for borrowers with the debt currently. So what does that all mean in terms of risk for housing? Now, we talked about the barbecue stopper. I'm still not quite sure why the barbecue and RSR work for a banking risk. I don't get more questions about the future of Basel Committee deliberations on the internal credit model. It does always tend to be housing. But I'm a good risk manager, so when I get asked the question, is it a bubble, what do you think house prices are going to do, I tend to deflect that line to our economists and say, they're in the business of making forecasts. As a risk manager, I'm more interested if I'm asked the question to say, well, what happens if they do drop? I'm not saying they will drop, but what does it mean for us and for our portfolio if they do drop, and if they do drop sharply? And that is actually, in a lot of ways, more important than the likelihood of whether it will not drop or not from a risk management point of view. So perhaps an analogy would be helpful here. If you've got a construction site and you're looking at a barrier around the roof that's been erected to stop people injuring themselves if they fall off building on the top of the building. Now, the decision from the site manager to put that barrier around is probably not based on an accurate estimate of how likely it is for one of his or her workers to fall off. It's much more focused on what would happen if they did. It would be pretty devastating. And that similar line of thinking really comes to mind when you think about portfolio risk, particularly for something like the Australian mortgage portfolio, because historically, our losses have been very low. Our historical loss rates on those portfolios have been very low. But it's a very large portfolio, so we really have to constantly ask ourselves that what-if question. And taking that building analogy a bit further, it's probably worth noting that there are also a lot of regulations in place to make sure that there are minimum safety standards put in place, rather than just relying on each builder running each site having very good risk management practices. And in much the same way, regulators such as APRA will also provide guidance on minimum standards for sound lending practices and won't just rely on the banks doing the right thing across the industry. So that's probably a good entree to giving you a bit of a flavour of how we think about our stress testing program, which is an increasingly important part of the way we think about risk, not just for our mortgage portfolio, but all of our business. So we use the results of our stress testing for a whole range of things. We can use it to tune our underwriting policies, inform the setting of risk appetite for different parts of our business, but also support portfolio decisions. And here's how we basically step through it. We start by setting up a suite of scenarios that outline things that could reasonably, plausibly occur, but would be fairly severe in terms of their consequence. Then we try and work through, well, what could that mean in terms of economic impacts? We look at a range of key economic indicators that will flow through, and then we'll say, well, what would those indicators translate to in terms of modelling potential flow-through impacts for the performance of the portfolio? So to take a concrete example, we might, for example, consider the possibility of a severe slowdown in China that flows through to the rest of Asia, and obviously that's an important, very important trading partner and source of GDP for Australia. And so what might that do to the economy in Australia? Now, first of all, it could trigger a sharp decline in property values, and that might involve falls have a greater degree in some regions rather than others. There might be certain industries that are affected more that flows onto regional portfolios. That we also have to think about the timing of those devaluations. Sharp fall after a sharp rise can give quite a different result from a sharp drop after a sort of more gradual growth period, because obviously that's going to affect the mix of your dynamic versus your origination loan-to-value ratio. But also think through what would that mean for GDP growth in Australia, what would it mean for unemployment rates, for our consumer lending portfolios. Unemployment is one of the most significant drivers of credit risk, because obviously if people are out of a job, it makes it a lot harder to service debt. And we also think about interest rates, and this one tends to be the topic of a lot of debate. Whenever we sit through with a whole group of people across the bank to work through and sort of develop the narrative for these scenarios, we always run into this challenge that our economists will tell us that when you're in a stress scenario, interest rates can't rise, which obviously isn't going to add to the stress. But often when we're thinking through these things, we're wanting to say, well, what could be the risks to the portfolio? So we often want to think about scenarios where you might see interest rate rises at the same time as broader stress. So certainly the case of our mortgage portfolio, pushing those sorts of assumptions through our credit models do lead to a significant increase in losses relative to historical experience. Now that's not only because obviously default rates would rise and unemployment spikes up and so on, but particularly important for the mortgage portfolio is that any assumption about rapid house price declines is going to mean that far more of those defaulting borrowers have got less collateral to support, and so your second way out, your foreclosure options don't recover nearly as much money. And that's one of the key things for the historical loss experience of banks. Part of the reason why our losses have been so low, it's not because people don't default on their debt, but that by and large when they do, we're more than fully covered by the value of the property. But even with that heightened stress, what we consistently see is that although loss rates certainly do rise for the mortgage portfolio, they typically remain lower than the loss experiences we see on most of our other lending portfolios. So then there's a number of things we do with these stress test outcomes. One of the most important things, and this is an important process that all banks go through, is to think about that overall impact on the bank in order to assess our capital resilience. So do we have the ability to absorb those losses while maintaining, staying solvent and also, better still, remaining above minimum capital requirements from a regulatory perspective? So what we think about our different sources of capital. So we've got our common equity, our Tier 1 capital, which is the first source of loss absorption. And then there's various other layers. We'll think about our additional Tier 1 instruments, so that's qualified hybrid debt instruments. Tier 2 capital, they're moving on to qualifying subordinated debt. So all of that together gives our total, what's referred to as regulatory capital. That's all available to absorb losses ahead of debtors, depositors, and the like. And so in terms of thinking through the adequacy of each of those components, the way we usually think about it is looking at the capital as a ratio relative to our assets. And usually we tend to do this on a risk-adjusted basis. So we'll look at our risk-weighted assets and look at the ratio of capital to those risk-weighted assets. And in terms of regulatory requirements, there's a minimum for the CET1, Common Equity Tier 1 ratio, of 4.5% of risk-weighted assets. And going forward, on top of this, there'll be new capital conservation buffers of additional 3.5% for a bank like Westpac, and that includes what's known as the DSIB, Domestic Systemically Important Bank Buffer. So that gets us to a total of minimum of 8% for that Common Equity Tier 1 ratio. And obviously, under stress, we want to ensure that we remain well above that. We don't want to find ourselves that, in the event of stress, where not only are we losing money to shareholders, but we're finding ourselves at strike with the regulator because we're not following our prudential requirements. So when we model the sensitivities of the portfolio, and the whole portfolio, the mortgage portfolio in particular, we'll take those scenarios, we'll project through the losses, we'll also look at how risk-weighted assets change as well, because as well as directly suffering losses, we'll tend to see risk will tend to elevate in the portfolio, so the risk-weighted assets will tend to go up. So not only do we see movements on the numerator, but the denominator moves as well. We'll also, to a degree, be able to take into account management responses. We might be able to reprice some products to offset some of the losses. and we'll consider capital raising options. But the upshot of all of that is that we'll end up sizing how much of a buffer under those sorts of severe stress scenarios do we think we need, that we're confident that even in the event of stress, we'll be okay from a regulatory minimum perspective. And that all translates at the moment to what we've made public, which is our preferred range is at between 8.75% and 9.25%. So that's, that's, we consider on the basis of our stress testing gives us that level of comfort above the regulatory minimum. Now, that sort of capital adequacy assessment is, it's been a long-standing application of stress testing. It's obviously very important. But arguably, it's primarily of interest to senior management, the board, and regulators, and it can seem a long way away from the day-to-day business of bankers who are out there originating lending. So what we've been doing increasingly over recent years is you're trying to use stress testing in much more targeted ways as well. So when we think about particular segments of our mortgage portfolio, so for example, we might be thinking about growth and lending to non-resident borrowers or to self-managed super funds. So these are all small segments but that have been seeing quite rapid growth of late. Or we might also look at segments such as lending into areas of high urban density development, so central Melbourne, central parts of Sydney and the like. We can use stress testing to assess the concentrations of risk we have in those areas and help inform the appetite that we might have. So, for example, we might set our maximum appetite for loss in a stress scenario for a particular segment, and using stress testing we can work backwards to say, well, what does that mean in terms of how much appetite do we have for growth in that segment? What's the level at which we start saying, we're probably not comfortable seeing that grow much further unless we see corresponding growth elsewhere to round out the concentrations. And those sorts of pieces of analysis can then inform changes to our underwriting settings. We might decide to slow a certain segment by, for example, lowering maximum loan-to-value ratios and so on. Now, one of the criticisms that can always be levelled against this kind of stress testing approach is that, and it's true for any scenario modelling, is that any one scenario you pick is unlikely to be what actually transpires. It's just a scenario, and in the real world, we tend to get surprised and things pan out differently from the way they have been in the past. But notwithstanding that level of uncertainty, that doesn't in any way stop this kind of stress testing being a really useful, critical tool for shaping your portfolio thinking and the process of working through the risk sensitivities of your portfolio. And it is an art as much as a science. You've got to have that careful blending of the commercial judgment with the quantitative analysis. But as I say, we're seeing it as a really powerful platform for thinking through risk appetite, risk settings, and business strategy. So that's really how we think about mortgages today. But what's on the horizon, what's coming? So 2 minutes. So you might have covered some of this ground this morning with Wayne Byles. Unfortunately, I missed that this morning, but did see him speak yesterday. And one of the things that's obviously very front of mind for banks are the changes to risk weights for mortgages. So the FSI, the Financial System Inquiry, presented a recommendation to close the gap between advanced IB banks, so the major banks, and standardised banks, which is largely the regional banks here in Australia. And APRA is taking a first step, which comes into effect July next year, which will go a long way to closing that gap. Now, there is a lot of concern that the deliberations globally from the Basel Committee might end up doing away with models altogether. Now, I don't know if Wayne mentioned that this morning, but yesterday he said that although he wouldn't bet his house, he didn't think models were dead just yet. Maybe they're resting, but not quite dead. Certainly our view is that the most likely scenario is there might be restrictions on the use of models for certain segments, but modelling will continue to play a really important role in determining capital. But regardless of how those capital decisions play out over the next couple of years, certainly at Westpac, we expect that this sort of portfolio modelling and analysis will remain really critical to the way we think about our risk appetite, policy settings, and risk awareness across the organisation. So I've got no expectation that there'll be any reduction in the use of these sorts of models. So where does that leave us? Is it the best time for mortgages? Well, I think I'll probably, like the house price question, I'll probably dodge the question and just go back to that 1986 Best of Times movie and say that unlike Robin Williams' character Jack Dundee, we can't go back and correct our past mistakes. So we just need to make sure that the decisions we make today are fully informed, tested, and that even if it turns out that we're headed for the worst of times, that that we can still cope with the stresses that will come through. So with that, I might hand over to questions.
Sure. So, we open the floor to question and answer. But just before I do, just to remind everyone, if you are on Twitter, hashtag banking on change, if you are trying to follow this. So yeah, so I want to, someone want to kick us off?
Thank you. My name is Jesse Trahan from Pepper Investment Management. And I guess one of the things that Wayne Byers brought up this morning was the 10% investor mortgage growth cap that they've brought in. And he said it was more of a response to underwriting standards as opposed to trying to affect or slow house price growth. What's your view on mortgage underwriting and lending standards?
This one on?
Yep.
So look, one of the ways I think about this is that there are a number of different related but distinct risks when it comes to mortgage lending. And I think the useful way of thinking them through is to take the perspective of each of the key regulators that think in this space. So you've got APRA, who are very much focused on prudential supervision. So they basically want to make sure that banks don't lose too much money and depositors are protected. You've got the Reserve Bank that have a dog in this race, and they're interested in the stability of the overall financial system. And then you've got ASIC, who are more focused on responsible lending and protecting individual customers. So they're worried about the borrowers, APRA's worried about the depositors, and the RBA is worried about the system. Now, obviously, those risks are all interlinked. I mean, if you provide an unsuitable loan to a customer who can't afford it, they're more likely to default, they're more likely, if they, a lot of those borrowers default, it's more likely to create problems for the system. But it does influence the way that those different regulators think and their priorities. They also talk. There is the Council of Financial Regulators. They discuss and share these sorts of things. So what I would say is that the first kind of move in this so-called macroprudential space, and I know APRA doesn't like the term, was about a year ago, or actually just a bit over a year ago, when APRA released a guide on reinforcing sound lending practices for mortgage lending. And so needless to say, what all the banks did was, the first thing we did was benchmark our own practices internally against those things. And I think probably like all banks, we thought that, you know, we looked pretty good on most of those things, but there are probably a few areas where we thought, you know, this is maybe an opportunity to kind of rethink some of those aspects. So, which obviously has the desired effect from APRA's point of view. They like to pick the best standard that every bank, each individual bank has, and then hold everyone to that standard. So that's definitely been part of their program for a while. The 10% came a bit later, and I think it's no surprise that it links very tightly into some of the concerns that the Reserve Bank had been putting in some of their financial stability review reports over a period of time. But they saw it at the growth in investor lending as a lack of balance in the system, and the concern there is that if that were to result in speculative rises in house prices that then fell back down rapidly, there'd be a wealth effect that would be likely to be quite damaging to the economy and not support financial stability. So from their point of view, that was something that they'd like to see. Now, if we're back in the old days when there was just the one regulator, a bit like the RBNZ, where financial stability and prudential supervision came in the same place, they probably just would have put the cap straight on. And, you know, I'm speculating to a large extent here, but I think, you know, it's probably a bit too clean to say, you know, the 10% is purely prudential and, you know, it's got nothing to do with the RBA's concerns. I think it serves both purposes. And certainly from our point of view, in terms of looking at risks in our portfolio, and I think it would be true of a lot of the other major banks, we haven't really seen any great indicator that investor as a segment is riskier from a credit point of view than owner-occupier. There are certainly riskier segments, high LVR, absolutely. People who are more stretched on serviceability, absolutely. But interestingly, and it's not a massive effect, but for example, we tend to see lower loan-to-value ratios on investor. And that part of that is because a lot of investors don't like to pay lenders mortgage insurance and will borrow up to 80% but no more, so they don't pay LMI. So that self-selection tends to give low effects. So we certainly haven't seen that. And I think also the Australian market is very different from some offshore markets. The buy-to-let market in the UK saw a lot of problems, but it's quite different from our market here. So my personal view is I don't see investor as a inherently high-risk signal segment, but I think, you know, it sort of positioned nicely in sort of prudential space, but I think my own view is it'd be more serving that balanced macro stability point of view than purely underwriting. I mean, a whole lot of other things that APRA's focused on, such as serviceability and so on, I think is much more clearly in the underwriting space.
Thanks, Sean.
My name's Adam. I'm from APRA. Just wanted to talk about stress testing, Sean. So you touched on stress testing. So at APRA, I've been lucky enough to be involved in some sort of stress testing over there as well, done some training courses on it. And I guess the biggest challenges are predicting the future and the multiple factors that are involved with stress testing. So usually there are multiple factors, like you mentioned, like GDP growth, unemployment, interest rates involved. I guess what's the biggest fear for a bank like Westpac in terms of a lot of things usually are correlated? So things like bank interlending in Australia is a big deal. Deposit runoffs, wholesale funding market being cut off, house prices falling down, and we've seen things like total loss absorbing capacity for G-SIBs being introduced now, which could be a thing for D-SIBs as well. I guess from Westpac point of view, what's the biggest sort of fear of these sort of things happening?
Okay, well, correlation is one of those notoriously difficult things to deal with because it's real. You know, as you say, when things go wrong, they tend to all go wrong at once. So in our stress testing, in our sort of internal capital models, we do try to give a lot of thought to correlation, but it is a tricky thing to calibrate. So what we tend to often do is just try and understand sensitivities, that if those correlations went up, how much worse could it be? And I think that's one of the advantages about doing this sort of stress testing in a portfolio-wide sense, because you can see, well, what's happening in different parts of the portfolio at the same time. Interestingly, what we've tended to see is in the sort of downturns we've had recently, there hasn't been as much correlation as we put in some of our stress tests. So, for example, during the financial crisis most recently, obviously credit losses were elevated for all the banks. I mean, we did pretty well compared to a lot of banks globally, but it was we lost about $3 billion. You know, that's a lot of money. But interestingly, it wasn't quite across the board. It was largely concentrated in corporate commercial property was one sector, but also the likes of ABC Learning, you know, some of those big, more leveraged corporates. But we saw a much more muted sort of flow through, a delayed and not as dramatic impact on some of the consumer and smaller business portfolios. So whereas in some of our stress tests, we tend to hit it with a harder correlation, which is prudent. So I think, I'm not saying we shouldn't do that, I think that makes sense. But I guess if you think about if you ask the question, what are we most worried about when we think about stress testing, one of the things that we think about is that although we can take comfort from the fact that we proved to ourselves that we look like we're going to be resilient, and that although obviously capital will be eroded when we lose money, that we'll stay above prudential minimums, we also then need to rebuild that capital because we articulate target capital ratios, and we want to demonstrate in that sort of scenario that to the market that we're strong, and we'd want to recapitalise and get back into our target levels as soon as possible. And one of the things that we've been giving a lot of thought to, and it was something that Wayne Byers mentioned last year when he gave a speech on stress testing, was thinking through what does that capital raising look like if all the banks are having to do it at the same time. So we've seen quite a bit of capital raising in various forms just recently, but that's not in response to stress environment, that's in response to kind of, you know, needing to adapt to sort of increasing capital requirements. But, you know, we sort of think through, well, what does that capital raising look like in stress conditions if everyone's trying to raise it at the same time? And can the market absorb that? How much of a discount, how much of a dilution would you have to have? And I think that's really interesting space for considerations like things like countercyclical buffers and that sort of thing. You know, is there a mechanism where you can essentially put, you know, banks have managed to stay above absolute minimum, but can you put a pause on that rebuild need? But each of us are obviously going to want to prove to the market that we're not the last to move because we're somehow weak. So that's kind of the most interesting dynamic that we're thinking through at the moment.
Thanks, Sean.
Don Johnston from Deloitte. Just a follow-up question, Sean, on the stress testing. In a stress scenario, have you thought through the possibility of the big banks becoming major property owners? So if there's a lot of defaults and you decide for liquidity reasons or whatever, or to stop the cycle, that you may be better off holding, and what would that look like?
Look, really good question. I mean, we've actually, one of the things that we spent a bit of time on recently, because we've been giving a lot of thought to the mortgage portfolio in particular, as I've mentioned, is been thinking through not just what are the straight credit losses, but things like operational impacts and strategic decision making under stress. So your example is one. Probably what would be more likely to be the way we'd manage it is not so much that we would foreclose and hang on to the property, it's more that we'd think about what is the timing of foreclosure. So we'd be looking at that sort of arrangements where we may not move to foreclosure as quickly in those conditions if we didn't think the market can absorb it. You know, that has the advantage of trying to keep people in homes for longer if that's a better outcome. And what we tend to do with our collections process more generally is we want to not only maximise our outcome but to minimise the impact on the affected borrower. So there'll be some conditions where it actually is better off for everyone to sell quickly, because you don't want to see the value of the property fall further, because then the shortfall for the borrower is even bigger. But equally, there might be times where it actually makes sense to slow it down. But we also have been thinking through things like, you know, what's the operational demand of that? I mean, we size our collections team to a certain level based on current requirements. If that suddenly spikes, how do we resource up? How do we make call centre capacity work? You know, how do we deal with higher levels of customer queries, complaints, references to ombudsman? There's a whole lot of those things that would come along with that sort of stresses at all, but need not all translate into specific dollar losses, but definitely things you need to get to grip with anyway.
Thank you. I've got a question for James, if you like. So James, in your talk, you mentioned the $5.7 trillion value of the mortgage market versus the property market versus the 1.5, and you did touch on we need to do something with a lot of the people that have 100% ownership of their homes. I guess, do you have a view on reverse mortgages and how we can potentially open up that market, or what you see elsewhere overseas?
Look, of that $5.7 trillion, we estimate that, you know, conservatively $500 billion at least is held in the hands of seniors over the age of 65 and owned outright. So when you think about some of the property challenges, especially again looking at first home buyers, often a challenge is the supply of property. And if at the moment for many retirees there is no encouragement for them to downsize from their family home, because the family home is the single purest asset means test exempt item that they can have in their household portfolio. The moment they downsize from that home and release equity, suddenly that equity becomes potentially means tested. So for many people, they're not encouraged to downsize, which means they sit on those properties and therefore the supply doesn't come to the market, and therefore it affects the demand supply balance for property prices. So if there is a way that there can be greater encouragement to facilitate even an intergenerational transfer of equity value from, because often you may have grandparents down to the grandchildren, or some way of supporting that, then it may actually have more beneficial interest, not just in helping retirees to access their equity, but also the broader property market to bring supply of housing stock to the market. While at the moment there's probably a lot of housing stock from retirees that simply they're not willing to bring to the market because they're not comfortable in downsizing for all the pension entitlement impacts, as well as other aspects of family home ownership. I might just have one comment on the investor comment that Sean was just talking to earlier, and the sort of speed limit on investor lending. It's very interesting to point out as well that we shouldn't categorise all investors as high net worth individuals which are heavily geared and they've got multiple investment properties. In fact, what we're seeing recently is a dynamic where it's the first home investor rather than the first home buyer. So many people are realising, you know, I simply can't be an owner-occupier for my first mortgage, but so they will buy a property, often a unit, in an area where they've got an aspiration to live in the future, but they simply can't afford that at the moment, so they'll buy it and then rent it out and use that and take advantage of negative gearing, and they'll rent further out, let's say, and then over time have the desire to move into that property that they're renting out. So we should be careful that by targeting investors, and for all the right reasons that Sean mentioned, but you know, for many first home buyers, they're moving to be first home investors as a way to get into the property market, and we don't want to see that, you know, adversely caught up in this whole perception of investors and slowing that growth down.
Sorry, perhaps to James, Robert asked. Now, I just wondered in the surveys you were doing whether any of the participants gave thought to how much is enough in terms of mortgages as a percentage of their total balance sheet. I know Wayne Byers said 40%. I actually thought it was closer to 60, which sort of reflects Westpac. And I suppose post-GFC, non-retail credit growth has been negligible. ROEs on mortgages in Australia are substantially better than ROEs on any other type of lending. You've got negative gearing, you've got means testing, etc. I just wondered whether any of them sort of thought, because for most banks I would have thought it shifted, you know, sort of from 50 to 60 or 65% over the last 7 years.
Still two-thirds of the earnings will come, and that's probably reflected in the asset base.
So at some point it means, where are they going to generate?
Look, I think in the current environment, the comment is that the mortgage is still the single product entry point you want with that household. Once you lock that in, you lock in a lot of the others, the credit cards, the other investments, any personal lending, whatever, it gets locked in. And indeed, these days, with many small business owners, they'll cross-collateralise their residential with their small business as well, so it becomes heavily entwined. So it still is, if you like, the utopia asset to get on a household balance sheet if you're the lender. But I think in the future, if we think through the way this cycle could play out in 5 to 10 years' time, the generations coming up now, age 20 to 30, they may not actually be able to afford property or even want to be homeowners, in which case then how does a lender actually resonate with those individuals? What do they want and what do they expect of a lender? If it's not going to be the mortgage, what other product or services is it that those lenders need to start to offer? So some of the more proactive groups are thinking that through going forward. How do they interact with the new millennials and the other generations coming through if they won't be able to really target the mortgage as the primary product foothold?
Do you have any other questions? Peter?
Thanks for that. Peter Sinkins from NAB. I just had a question. How, and it's probably more to James than to Sean, but there's kind of a lot of talk around the price income salary type levels of Australia versus other countries. I guess my question is, are we really that different, and if so, why do we believe that's the case?
Yeah, maybe Sean can answer, because I'm pretty sure whenever the major banks go offshore to actually raise some funding, that's probably the first question they get asked is, how can your property market still be surviving and with this sort of gearing ratio? So I'm sure you've got some insights, but from what I've heard around the market, I mean, it can be very hard to compare Australia with other countries. You know, certainly we've got the full recourse environment here. If you're a lender, you've got full recourse to other assets, and that does change the borrowers' approach to repayment, particularly for owner-occupied lending. You've also got the fact that a lot of our capital cities are on you know, harbour side or on coastal areas rather than inland, and you've got heavy industry and economic concentration in key capital cities, which is where the bulk of the majority of the property stock can be. So that does change, you know, who's the benchmark group you should compare it to. Is it London or New York or whomever? So you need to make sure you're comparing like with like. But just more generally, what we've seen in Australia certainly is from there has been a, you know, something in the late 90s, 2000s and up to now, a heavy increase in the gearing, overall household gearing. And Sean mentioned earlier, certainly with the Aussie home loans and others coming on the market, that gave greater supply of credit to households. That was also around the same time as we saw the rise of dual income households, if you like, where people had both adults earning an income, and that then allowed the gearing to go higher, and obviously it was with property prices supporting that. So, but as a colleague of mine once said, so once you've moved beyond having good supply of money and a dual income household, well, where do you go? Do you ask the kids to start to pay money? So you start to cap out once you get to the dual income household, and so probably the levels we're at now, it's hard to see it going much beyond that. I suppose more from a regulatory point of view or from a systemic point of view is that a risk level that we're happy to have across our mortgage portfolios? And so far, it's had a pretty good performance, even at that level, as Sean said, for various reasons around why the losses are relatively low at the moment for mortgages. I think it's certainly hard when comparing Australia with others. There are certain aspects of Australia which do support the property market, and also from the tax structure with negative gearing, and also from the pension sector where there's a very strong desirability for people to actually own their own home and keep that as they move through retirement. But Sean, any thoughts?
Yeah, look, I'd echo a lot of that. I mean, when people tend to try and pick out certain key metrics and compare them across the world, you know, the economists still do it, other commentators will do it, but sort of implicit in any of those sorts of analysis is that there is some long-term equilibrium level that's right. And, you know, in some of those metrics, there's just no way to pick what that is, or even if there is one. And if I think the sort of prices to average income is a good example. I mean, you can probably make more of a case for, you know, yield-type measures, so, you know, price to rent, that you know, you'd expect that to be, you know, somewhat linked to real interest rates generally. But, you know, what is the normalising driver for price to average incomes? And I think James is spot on when he talks about that coastal point, because there have been studies that look in the US, for example, and once you break that down and control for location, it actually becomes a tale of two areas. You've got, you know, you take places like Phoenix, you know, where it's desert, and you can sort of build out in any direction and it's pretty much the same. You do get, you know, they have seen over long periods of time fairly stable, you know, price to income levels, because basically if you don't like the price, you'll just buy a bigger, nicer house, you know, in the next new suburb. And you know, the availability of land for opening up new supply tends to be much easier in those sort of central parts of America. But then you look at coastal cities, you know, places like San Francisco and so on, the dynamic tends to look a lot more like what we're used to seeing, in that, you know, they're concentrated on the coast, there's not really nearly as much area to expand, there might be sort of inland, but it tends not to, you know, to be seen as kind of a homogeneous and equivalent. People don't necessarily want to keep expanding away from where the centre of action is. And so what you tend to find is that, I mean, we don't have a lot of our real estate in those non-coastal areas, and so I think you do have to be careful about what you compare it to. But I think the right question is, that can explain where it's come historically, but doesn't necessarily give you much of a guide. There's no reason why, you know, it should come up, but equally there's no reason why it, you know, has to fall back down to a long-term level either.
Do you have any other questions? I've got one more to ask around. So you spoke about the people falling off the roof and minimising risk as opposed to actually determining the likelihood of when property prices are going to fall. Can you talk to us a little bit about, well, what are the banks doing around minimising the risk over and above just holding more capital that APRA's told us to be able to be in a position that if it does happen, what are the banks doing to actually prepare for that?
Well, I guess I touched on one of the key tools that you have for mortgage lending, which you don't necessarily have for all parts of your lending portfolio, and that's loan-to-value ratio. I mean, you know, the first thing you want is you want your borrowers to be able to service their debt. But if they can't repay, you know, you've got the second way out of selling the property. And so you want to try and be as sure as you can be that in that situation, that will largely cover what's so that's why that's one of the key tools that if we do see heightened concentration risk or, you know, areas that we think are greater risk for some other reason, one of the key tools is modulating that maximum loan-to-value ratio. And as I said, with things like lender's mortgage insurance, that tends to self-select people a bit lower as well. So that's one thing. The other thing sort of all the things that go into the underwriting decision in the first place. So one of the things that we've always reviewed regularly and has got a lot more focus over the last year has been serviceability assessments. So there was a really useful exercise that APRA conducted last year, which was what was called the hypothetical borrower exercise, where basically they came up with these four hypothetical little narratives, you know, single person, a couple, two owner occupiers, two investors, here's their credit card debt, here's, you know, here's their income and so on, and gave it to, you know, I think it was 17 different banks and said, you know, run it through your serviceability test. Don't worry about your credit scoring or your loan to value ratio or anything else. Let's just focus on that serviceability test and, you know, break it down into the component parts. What would you take away as the income? Because banks will all do things like discount variable sources of income, rent and the like. And then that was basically pulled together, anonymized, and the results are given back to us. And that, you know, for a bank, that's gold, because, you know, we can't, you know, we can do a bit of mystery shopping and so on, but you know what your own settings are. It's much harder to know what everybody else's settings are, because they, you know, we review our settings, we move, others do as well. And what you don't want, you know, when it comes to that sort of credit underwriting, is to be the last one to move on anything, because particularly through brokers, they'll find the weakest link. So, you know, we can see it a bit when you see, you know, bits of flow, but seeing, well, you know, maybe on something like the assumed rate of repayments on credit card debt, maybe, you know, we've been less conservative there than other banks, but we're more conservative on, for example, applying interest rate buffers to all debts. You know, we'll basically be able to really narrow in and say, look, there are the areas where, you know, we're at risk of being picked off, and so we can move. So those sorts of things have provided, you know, an extra piece of insight for us. But those sorts of things, looking at all of those settings, you know, it's a very dominating process. It's not really a set and forget. We're constantly reviewing all of those settings as well. So, and they're all the things that, you know, if you keep doing that dynamically, then if and when the crisis, a severe recession or a downturn does happen, then hopefully that will put your portfolio in a better shape.
Great. If there's any more questions, we'll have one more final question before we wrap up. So this one's for you, James. It's around one of the things that you also mentioned in your presentation was around the ability to actually raise deposits and how that's somewhat hindered nowadays given the current environment. I guess there's been mumblings in the industry at the moment around allowing people to access their super to then you know, use it to actually put as a deposit. I guess could you share with us your views on that?
Thanks for the toughest question last week. Look, the government did have a program called the First Home Buyers Savings Account, or FISA as the acronym was, and probably as the reality was too. unfortunately, not many people took that out. It was very restrictive, and people just didn't like that restriction. Effectively, if you didn't use the money for a deposit after a certain number of years, you got put into your superannuation. And whilst that may actuarially be a sound thing to do for people, it's not what people wanted. They wanted the cash back to them. So the government tried that and pulled it back. So therefore, if you're a first home buyer or aspirational first home buyer trying to save, where do you put those funds? Now, look, there often an example is quoted about the Singapore government system, the CPF, Central Provident Fund, where it does allow use of some of the savings built up for the purpose of housing. Look, that's a very different market, though. It's a very centralised market by the Singapore government. It does control a number of aspects across the property market, and also the contributions are significantly higher than our superannuation contributions. So it's very difficult to compare like for like there, but it is an interesting example of where a government that can mandate that level of high contribution can stipulate how you can use those monies. Look, I think a lot of people realise that, yes, okay, well, it's an opportunity to tap into your super to use for a house, and for many people, you know, a house does ultimately become a very sensible long-term investment in the current superannuation environment, simply because once you reach retirement, it's an exempt asset. So for many people, it's a sensible investment. A lot of people aren't convinced that that's the right mechanism to help people just by, if you like, depleting their superannuation in the future to actually purchase a property now. Is that really the right way to let people in this market? So I think it's more back to the drawing board, looking for other mechanisms to help support people. There's no silver bullet to solving first-time buyer affordability either, and I always think it's interesting if you talk to your parents or others, they say, well, it wasn't really very easy for them either to be a first-time buyer back in their day. So whilst there's a lot of studies that show it is harder now, and fair enough, it may well be, but, you know, it's never been an easy thing. But for a lot of people, they are looking at more broadly at parental support, parental pledges or guarantees. They are even looking at joint family purchases, where that can make sense. I said before, first-home investors, many people are becoming then using the rent to help negative gear and get the property, at least start to pay it off for a period of time initially. So people are looking at all these options from a sourcing a finance perspective. I think then also governments are realising supply has to become part of that issue as well. And if you're going to actually increase supply, and to Sean's point, You can certainly increase supply on the fringes of capital cities to the extent you've got available space. What often isn't there is the infrastructure to enable people to actually get to their place of work, and so that's where you've got the challenge. So while supply can be increased, it often housing can be built far quicker than what the infrastructure, the roads or the rail network can be to actually transport those people to work. So a whole bunch of macro demand and supply aspects need to be put together. There's no single sort of policy solution, such as something in a super, I think, that would solve any of it in the short term.
Thanks, James. So would everybody like to join me in thanking James and Paul?